Keith O'Brien's new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, is the true story of women willing to risk everything, even their lives, to do the thing they loved. It's the hidden history of women striving to change the world despite defeat after defeat. These female flyers, sometimes called fly girls, shattered the original glass ceiling, battled injustices, which feel all too timely today, fought the men trying to stop them, and ultimately, they prevailed. Keith O'Brien is a frequent contributor to NPR. He has written for the New York Times Magazine, Politico, and Slate. Fly Girls is his third book, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Keith O'Brien to the roundtable this morning. Keith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So what brought you to these five women and ultimately this story?
Well, I'm always looking for great story ideas. As a journalist, I'm always writing down little ideas and socking them away. And, you know, that's how I came upon this story. I was on an airplane from Boston to Pittsburgh in the spring of 2016. And for the flight, I had grabbed a book that had been sitting on my bedside table for some time. It was Lily Koppel's The Astronaut Wives Club. It was the story of the first seven astronauts, but told from the perspective of the wives. Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff is one of my favorite books of all time. And so I wanted to see how Lily had told this story from the opposite perspective. I was just a few pages into the book, and there was a paragraph about daring women and the history of daring women, and there's this reference to an all-female airplane race in 1929, a race that had featured Amelia Earhart. You know, I consider myself to be fairly well-educated, fairly well-read. I'd never heard of it, and I was on an airplane, of all places, and this airplane had Wi-Fi, and I was able to open my laptop and just start noodling around on it. And that's what it was at first, Joe. It was just me noodling around on it. But the more I read, the more I dug down, the more I knew there was something here. And by the time I landed in Pittsburgh, honestly, I knew there was something, and I knew I needed to get to a library, and that's where it all started.
So at this point of these air races, I mean, you write about this, they would draw 100,000 people, if not more, and they were paying to see this. What was it about these races that made them so popular at the time?
We forget now because, you know, the modern airlines have turned travel into at best a mode of transportation from point A to point B, and at worst a hassle. But in the late 1920s, there was real magic in flying, real romance in it. And the air races were a place where that magic really came to life. You know, as you said, you could have 100,000 paying fans in a single day, and another 100,000 who were sitting on the hoods of their parked automobiles on nearby highways watching these planes race. People wanted to see airplanes. Most people at that point had never flown in one, and to fly in one was to be almost a kind of gladiator. Because it was so romantic and so daring and so primitive, really, in its development, most men considered it the field for men. But there was a small squadron of women who refused to abide by that notion, and they wanted to not only fly airplanes, they wanted to race them too. And once they got into the air races, the female pilots were just as popular as the men, if not more so.
Your story begins in 1927. Why is that year pivotal?
Well, that's the year that Charles Lindbergh flies solo across the Atlantic. And, you know, in our mind now, we think of Lindbergh just doing this for the pioneering spirit of it. And certainly there was that. But what we forget is a wealthy New York hotel owner had put up $25,000. That's a lot of money in 1927. $25,000 for the first man, and it was presumed to be a man, to fly nonstop from New York to Paris or Paris to New York. A lot of men died trying to win that money. And finally, in the spring of 1927, Lindbergh succeeds. And when he succeeds, he instantly becomes not only rich, but he becomes one of the most famous men in the entire world and begins to travel across America in a goodwill tour that would visit some 90 cities, spreading, you know, essentially air fever. And inevitably, women were infected by the air fever as well. And by the late summer of 1927, just a few months removed from Lindbergh's success, a couple of women decide they will become the first woman to fly across the ocean. And it's interesting to note that neither of these women was named Amelia Earhart. Months before Amelia Earhart would fly the ocean in 1928, a couple of other women would try.
The women are very diverse. Talk a little bit about their backgrounds and how they come to this, because it's not like it's a set pattern.
Sure. So Amelia Earhart was a social worker in Boston. One of her main rivals, Ruth Nichols, was the daughter of Wall Street wealth in New York. Louise Sadin, close friends with both Ruth Nichols and Amelia Earhart, was from Bentonville, Arkansas, and had gotten her start selling coal, of all things, in Wichita, Kansas. Ruth Elder was an Alabama housewife, very flashy and already divorced once. And Florence Klingensmith was a young, daring pilot from rural Minnesota just across the Red River from Fargo. These women, as you said, were very different. They came from different backgrounds. Some came from money, some didn't. Some were educated, some weren't. But they did have a few things in common. You know, all of these women had a daring streak to them. They would ride motorcycles. They would jump out of the second-story window of barns just to see what it felt like. They would ride the train around town by hanging off the cow catcher just a few inches off the rails. They all had a daring spirit. They would all be what we would call today early adopters, you know, to fly. To get on an airplane in 1927, 1928 was to be bold, much less to fly it. So these women were early adopters. They had a pioneer streak to them. And I think most interesting for people today is their parents. You know, in 1927, 28, a young woman was expected to do one of just a couple of things. You know, society expected her to get married and to have children, or if she were to work, hold one of just a couple of jobs. Certainly these expectations were on these women too. But it's interesting to note that when these characters chose a different path, when they chose to fly, their fathers did not stop it. They did not stand in the way. They did not throw a fit and say no. In some cases, the fathers of these women actually encouraged the flying. And in other cases, they just looked the other way. And I think it's an interesting parenting lesson to see that these fathers in the late 1920s chose to let their daughters find their own path in the world.
Keith O'Brien is our guest. The name of the book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Was it ever a challenge for you as a writer to not have Amelia Earhart take over the book?
Certainly, Amelia Earhart looms large in our minds today. She is essentially the only female aviator who is celebrated, who is remembered from this time. And I think there was a time early on in the process here, Joe, early on in the writing process, where I had to remind myself, I'm not writing a biography of Amelia Earhart. That is not my purpose. In the time that she was flying, these other women were right there with her. And some of them were arguably more skilled in a cockpit than she was. And so my goal from the outset was to tell a narrative that weaved together all of their stories, their friendships and their rivalries, their triumphs and their tragedies. It was in some ways more challenging to write that kind of story, but it is the story of that time. You know, Amelia was not alone. These other women were with her.
Did what happened to her have an impact on the other women?
What happened to her in the end, you mean, her disappearance?
Yes.
Absolutely. You know, it was devastating, of course. You know, when Amelia disappeared while trying to fly around the world in 1937, it was a crushing blow for everyone. She was so celebrated, so iconic. She was a legend. And for these women, she was their friend, in some cases, one of their only friends, a woman who could truly understand them as pilots. But it's also worth noting this, you know, Amelia understood the risks of her flight. She knew that if things went wrong over the ocean, it would not end well for her. And her friends knew it too. Louise Staden was probably Amelia's closest friend of these women. And when Amelia went missing and people, reporters, inevitably called Louise to ask her what does she think happened to Amelia, Louise said, you know, clearly she has died. You know, she hit the ocean and she drowned. That was Louise's belief because she and Amelia had talked about it. They knew that if something went wrong over the ocean, it would not end well.
It brings up a point, and you've used the word rivals and even in friendships, and certainly the rivalry makes sense, but by the same token, these are five women who share this love and they share this interest, which had to bring them close together in some way, shape, and form.
Sure. I mean, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, if you were a female aviator, and more than that, you were a woman who dared to race airplanes, there wasn't a lot of other women who could understand that passion, who could understand what you were up against, and specifically could understand the kind of discrimination that you were flying into. And so these women did share that. They did understand how difficult it was to do what each of them was doing. And because of that, they did at times become close. And just as important, Joe, you know, they organized. You know, the women in Fly Girls, you know, would organize and form a group of women pilots, you know, by women pilots, for women pilots, called the 99s. This organization still exists today. And they would use this organization to fight for their rights to be part of the air races.
What do you think ultimately we should take from the story today?
You know, I think this story is for anyone who's ever been told you're not good enough, you don't belong here, you can't do this, and for anyone who's ever stood up to those kind of naysayers who stared down that kind of bully and said, I think you're wrong. You know, these women did that again, again, and again. You know, they were determined to fly in the face of rules that were intended to keep them in their place. But I think it's also worth making another point here. You know, this book isn't just for women. It's not just for girls. I think it's just as important for men to read it, for young boys to read it, and to see that women are just as smart as they are, just as brave as they are, just as fearless as they are.
Well, the name of the new book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and Keith O'Brien will be at Northshire Bookstore on Saturday at 6 p.m., Saturday the 11th of August at 6 p.m., You can find out more information by going to Northshire.com. Northshire.com. Keith O'Brien, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program. Best of luck with the book.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, Keith O'Brien will be at Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont on Saturday night, 6 o'clock on August 11th. The name of the book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.